You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy Lendlease Episode 9, our summer podcast spinoff of the Arsenal for Democracy radio show. For any new listeners, we're in the home stretch of our podcast, just two or three more episodes to go before we have to go on hiatus during my campaign. This is a public policy and history podcast, one of the things that we often talk about is various historical elements of the left in the United States or various other countries, and oftentimes talking about kind of what went wrong or things that could have been done better, or just, you know, generally that sort of those sort of anecdotes and so forth. As I mentioned on our previous episode, we've got a couple episodes coming up about anarchism in the United States, things like the IWW and stuff like that in the late 19th century, early 20th century. So a lot of the stuff that we're going to be covering ends up culminating in the first Red Scare during and after World War I. Today, however, we're going to be talking about something a little bit later than that, which is U.S.-Soviet relations and therefore also the Communist Party activities in the United States during the FDR administration. So this would be, we're talking about 1933 until when FDR died, and then a little bit after that in the Truman administration at the end of World War II. We're not going to be talking too much this week about the Communist Party activities in the immediate aftermath of the Russian Revolution and the first Red Scare, because some of that stuff is going to come up in the anarchism episodes. So we're mostly focusing this week on the U.S.-Soviet relations. So joining me this week on the line, as usual, is Nate. Hi, Nate.
Hey, Bill.
And Rachel is away this week, so filling in again is our old reliable friend Greg, also on the line. Hi, Greg.
Old and reliable. That's very kind of you.
Yeah, much like an old dog, right? Well, I don't know how much Greg knows about U.S.-Soviet relations under FDR, so I think he might be here mostly for comic relief, especially when we get to, you know, Henry Wallace's guru and so forth. But
I love him.
We will be talking about U.S.-Soviet relations and Communist Party activities. There were a few books that we had looked at potentially, you know, trying to read before this and ended up not having time, partly because I had been reading a bunch of books on the anarchism stuff for the upcoming episodes. There's a book that looked kind of interesting to me, but I did not get a chance to read it, that was called FDR and the Soviet Union, The President's Battles Over Foreign Policy by Mary E. Glantz. That was published in February 2005. And basically, she's talking about FDR's peaceful accommodation strategy in the run-up to World War II. So this is before the, you know, Comintern joined the Allies. Saying that FDR personally was trying to promote a more conciliatory policy toward the Soviet Union and had a little bit of success, as we'll talk about, but was mostly, she argues, stymied by lower level officials, especially in the State Department, who were deeply committed to opposing the Soviet Union. But again, I didn't get a chance to read the book, so I don't have too much more on that, but I wanted to recommend it to people as a potential resource. The sort of big success early on that FDR had, which obviously had important ramifications as World War II approached, was in November of 1933, when the U.S. restored diplomatic relations with the Soviet Union. So for those who don't remember the exact chronology, In late 1917, the Bolshevik communists had seized power in the Soviet Union in the second phase of the Russian Revolution. This was about 6 months or so after the U.S. had entered World War I. And then in 1918, and then after the end, because the war ended in November of 1918, about a year later, after that period, the U.S. and British did a combined invasion of northern Russia in an attempt to suppress the Russian Revolution, or the Bolshevik phase of the Russian Revolution and the Russian Civil War that was by then underway. They were ultimately unsuccessful in that, but that's, let's say, got the U.S. off to a bad start with relations with the new power that was subsequently named the Soviet Union. But FDR, one of his early objectives in his first year in office was noting the fact that basically at that point, you know, the U.S. was the only major power that still hadn't recognized the Soviet Union, and there was a lot of potential trade relationships that could be built there. And so he wanted to get that done. So the New York Times, there was an article from 2011 in the New York Times reflecting back on their coverage at the time. And they said the New York Times described the terms of the U.S.-Soviet agreement, reporting that the Soviets agreed to the most complete pledge against Bolshevist propaganda within the United States that has ever been made, and to allow Americans to have complete freedom of worship and the right to choose their own counsel if being tried in the Soviet Union. And they're talking about American, again, for both of those Americans within the Soviet Union, because that had been an issue, was that a number of Americans had been arrested during the sort of upheavals of the previous period. And the United States made reciprocal pledges except regarding religion, because the Soviets didn't really care about having freedom of religion for Soviet citizens in the United States. And there was an ongoing issue, which had been a major sticking point, about wartime debts. A lot of that had to do with basically that Russia owed money, or the pre-Soviet Russian state owed money to the United States. And there were also American businesses that were seized and collectivized in the Russian Revolution. And they just decided to not worry about that. And it never really did get resolved, especially because World War II happened not that long after. That was sort of the big success that FDR had before the war, was normalizing those relations to the extent possible. Obviously, sort of, you know, we'll talk a little bit in just a second about the Communist Party USA in that time period, and this normalization and a bunch of other things, and then the events of World War II had a profound impact on their activities, because they were working very closely with the Soviet government and taking directions directly from them during this period. The next sort of big thing that happens, which Nate is going to talk some about, is about the extension of the Lend-Lease program, which was originally primarily geared toward Britain, and that was the United States providing aid after the summer of 1941, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union. There was a link that I've put in the outline that'll be up on arsenalfordemocracy.com, where you can read the joint message of assistance to the Soviet Union from President Roosevelt and Prime Minister Churchill. They didn't really say anything, you know, too special or whatever in this statement. It basically just talks about that they had sent an FDR aide to Moscow to figure out what, you know, help the Soviets needed in order to resist Hitler. And they also, and this is kind of, we always think of, in the current context, they talk about Nazism, but of course, at the time, FDR and Stalin and Churchill all called it Hitlerism, because there wasn't quite this coherent umbrella until after the war to describe what had happened. So they said, "We realize fully how vitally important to the defeat of Hitlerism is the brave and steadfast resistance of the Soviet Union, and we feel therefore that we must not in any circumstances fail to act quickly and immediately in this matter on planning the program for the future allocation of our joint resources." And this ended up becoming very critical. So Nate, you wanted to talk about some of the statistics of how much the Soviet Union benefited from the American Lend-Lease program before the entry of the United States into World War II, because, of course, this program was extended to the USSR in August of 1941, and Pearl Harbor didn't happen until December of 1941. So what do we need to know about that?
Right. Well, I think the important thing to realize is that a lot of the Lend-Lease program got ramped up as American production also got ramped up with the drive to war after. So a lot of the initial resources that got sent over were rather minimal. So, you know, there's some debate over, to what extent was Lend-Lease responsible for the Soviets winning the war and all of that. And it seems like, especially at, you know, these early turning points, say like at Stalingrad, there was not a lot of American material there. I think there was, I found a statistic that was like, it was only 7% of the vehicles at Stalingrad, but overall it eventually did get ramped up, and it amounted to about 20% of the total armored vehicles produced by Russia during the war. And most significantly, I would say, would be the use of these sort of half tracks or infantry fighting vehicles. Apparently, actually 100% of Russian infantry fighting vehicles were given over by Americans, because or the British as well. Because I guess they weren't producing those, or they were using those factories to produce tanks and things like that. And those ended up being very effective. But there was also a lot of other tanks being sent over. But overall, yeah, the U.S. supplied the Russians with 500,000 tactical wheeled and tracked vehicles, including Jeeps, 1.5 ton trucks and 2.5 ton trucks. And a lot of these were, you know, used as troop transports, able to carry munitions from place to place, or propel like gun carriages and things like that. And, were also had these multiple drive axles and were able to go off road. And if you think about the conditions on the Eastern Front, probably a lot of snow, a lot of mud.
That was a huge problem for the Nazis, was the mud.
Right. So, the Nazis were getting stuck in the mud. Basically, you had a little bit more mobility thanks to, the provisions that were coming over by, say, like 43, 44, when the Russians were starting to push back. There's a lot of quotes on this that come from various, sources. And
yeah, I was wondering, Greg, there were a couple quotes there from the Russia Beyond article. I was wondering if you wanted to read those. There was one from General Zhukov, who was one of the highest ranking Soviet generals, and then also Stalin himself.
Right. So Zhukov was saying, now they say that the Allies never helped us, but it can't be denied that the Americans gave us so many goods without which we wouldn't have been able to form our reserves and continue the war. We didn't have explosives, gunpowder. We didn't have anything to charge our rifle cartridges with. The Americans really saved us with their gunpowder and explosives, and how much sheet steel they gave us. How could we have produced tanks without American steel? But they make it seem as if we had an abundance of all that. Without American trucks, we wouldn't have had anything to pull our artillery with. I mean, we're really talking about they were in some dire straits, I think, at a certain point.
Yeah, I mean, the big advantage they had was they had the manpower, but then it doesn't do you any good to have the manpower if you don't have any, guns to put in their hands or vehicles to move them around.
You keep getting stuck in the
mud. They had to move a lot of people, across the Soviet Union away from the Japanese border to respond to the invasion. And then it's like, okay, but again, you still need to give them stuff to do there when they get to the front. And that Zhukov quote was specifically responding to this notion that, which was sort of a common propaganda line in the Soviet Union at the time, that like, oh, we're not getting any help from the Americans, and we're doing this all on our own. And he was saying, as someone who was the most in the know, look, that's not really accurate.
They even gave them alcohol. The United States even gave them a bunch of alcohol. It looks like 331,066 liters of alcohol, which I looked at consumption statistics for Russia. It's not going to cover that many people. But it's probably like under 25,000 people that could serve for an entire year. But at the same time, it's like they're giving them blanks as well. Blankets as well.
Yeah, like warm clothes and spam tins, boots, and things like that. Yeah.
Cotton, petroleum, food supplies. I mean, like, this was really significant.
Also, I think they've pointed to various types of radio equipment being extremely key, because it seems like in the initial Blitzkrieg offensive under Operation Barbarossa, a lot of the radio systems were disrupted or basically compromised so that like the Germans were listening in. And so there was a lot of radio equipment shipped over. Soviet Union was supplied with 35,000 radio stations, 380,000 field telephones, and 950,000 miles of telephone cable. So by 43, they were able to set up a network of radio control stations that allowed them to tactically direct the Air Force in order to repel the Germans. So, and I think there was also a lot of railway lines that got laid down, or like the steel was shipped in over from the United States, and that was able to allow them to increase their mobility and logistics. So, it's not always just like the fancy tanks or whatever and the guns that are really winning the day. It's oftentimes like the logistical support.
Mm-hmm. And what Stalin said in his letter to Roosevelt, he said, "Your decision, Mr. President, to give the Soviet Union an interest-free credit of $1 billion in the form of material supplies and raw materials has been accepted by the Soviet government with heartfelt gratitude as urgent aid to the Soviet Union in its enormous and difficult fight against the common enemy, bloodthirsty Hitlerism." There's that Hitlerism again.
Yeah.
There was also, this is interesting, so the U.S. sent over 200,000 Studebaker Army trucks and they became extremely popular with the Soviet forces, and the letters USA were stenciled on the side, which were translated in Russian to basically say, kill Hitler. They were getting a lot of aviation fuel as well, or just like basic things that you need, like copper, aluminum, rubber tires, and things like that. So, yeah, I think also on the issue of the railways, 56.6% of all rail construction during the war came from the U.S. and also nearly 2,000 locomotives, because the Soviets only had about 92. So this is kind of like the situation in like Hearts of Iron, where you're just doing the lend-lease and decreasing production for yourself, or at least the Brits were doing this and just sending all of the production over to the Soviets.
So let's turn now to talking about the Communist Party USA and their activities during the FDR administration and shortly after. There's a couple angles to talk about here. A lot of their decision-making was directly made in Moscow during this period, which had also been true of most of the 1920s, and we'll talk about that. And obviously, a lot of their activities were in the same area as a lot of the other leftist groups that we've talked about before, you know, the industrial cities and so forth in the United States. But before we get into that, I just wanted to briefly talk about, or Nate was going to briefly talk about, there's a book on some of their activities in the American South that you wanted to recommend people maybe check out, which I don't think we had a chance to read that as well, but it seems like it's a good resource.
Yeah, I mean, this book gets talked about a lot, and I definitely want to get a chance to read it at some point. But it's Hammer and Hoe by Robin Kelly, and it tells a story of the Alabama chapter of the Communist Party USA during the 30s and their efforts to unionize sharecroppers. So the founder of the Alabama Sharecroppers Union, and were working to, you know, get them paid, because oftentimes, you know, there was like some sort of advance theoretically that they would get, but of course they would not get it because of all sorts of racist factors. And they were also, you know, doing battle with the Ku Klux Klan, and, you know, a lot of times, because Ku Klux Klan are terrorists and will come after them. And so there was a lot of self-defense actions there, as well as they were doing a lot of organizing around the Scottsboro case, the famous trial in 31. So there was that. But then, of course, there's the famous quote from this book that gets passed around, and I thought we would read a little bit of it. So this is, you know, from the author coming and visiting to talking to people in the 80s. She says, "I wasn't prepared for characters such as Lemon Johnson, former member of the communist-led sharecroppers union. In December 1986, I visited Johnson in his home in rural Montgomery County, in which I described in my journal as a tiny rundown shack with battered wooden walls, a rusted tin roof that had begun to cave in, and a porch stocked with three rickety chairs. He fed me a huge lunch of collard greens, beans, Wonder Bread, fried chicken, and a slice of cake. We ate outside and talked for a while, and it became unbearably cold and moved inside, sat on his bed, and he slouched on a wooden chair next to me. A faded picture of Dr. Martin Luther King was tacked to the wall above his head. He told stories of the 1935 cotton picker strike, Stalin's pledge to send troops to Mobile to help black sharecroppers if things got out of hand, and the night a well-armed group of women set out to avenge their comrades who'd been beaten and killed during the strike. When I asked Mr. Johnson how the union succeeded in winning some of their demands, without the slightest hesitation, he reached into the drawer of his nightstand and pulled out a dog-eared copy of V.I. Lenin's What Is to Be Done and a box of shotgun shells, set both firmly on the bed next to me, and said, 'Right, Dar, theory and practice. That's how we did it, theory and practice.'" So, you know, you have people that are living in sharecroppers' huts. They're reading Lenin. They're arming themselves in resistance to white supremacist terrorism. And I think that is a powerful example of, you know, both what was going on then and perhaps also the current day.
That guy rules.
Now, Lemon is an awesome name.
Yes. First of all, yeah.
Now, as I said before, most of the decision-making was being made in Moscow, and there was very closely monitoring, as evidenced by Stalin's specific comments on the labor actions in Alabama. Most of this period that we're talking about, the leadership of the Communist Party in the United States was under Earl Browder. And he worked very closely with Comintern, the organization that was coordinating, you know, worldwide pro-Soviet communist efforts. He worked for them in East Asia in the interwar period before he was promoted to lead the CPUSA. So they basically kind of swing wildly back and forth during this period, depending on sort of Stalin's mood or the people around him in terms of what should be done within the U.S. And relative to the U.S. government and various other actors that they're interacting with. So in 1935, they... after a period of opposing participating in or dealing with traditional unions, they reversed course and started encouraging their members to, well, you could say integrate or infiltrate, depending on your preference, to get members and organizers into the traditional unions. This was during the New Deal, and basically they figured that this was their best way of, you know, getting people, like, building class consciousness in the working class and making sure that things were not co-opted into, like, a fascist direction or something like that. They began supporting the New Deal and FDR in 1935 as a popular front against rising fascism, and this again followed that 1933 agreement at the end of 1933 between the U.S. And the government and the Soviet Union. One of the stipulations had been in that agreement that the Soviet Union would kind of tamp down a little bit on their Bolshevik agitations in the United States. I don't know that they actually really did follow through on that, but this could potentially be seen as evidence of at least, you know, moderating a little bit. Browder continued his criticism pretty stridently initially after the agreement until I guess he was finally told not to. But interestingly, even though he was publicly criticizing, you know, FDR and the U.S. government in that period, he was also going periodically making the case to the officials in Moscow about this popular front concept of saying, no, we should actually change this. And he was eventually able to persuade them that this would be a good idea. So this included a reconciliation, not just with, you know, FDR and the New Deal, but also a reconciliation, more importantly, with various other socialist groups or anarchist groups or other left rivals to the CPUSA. Browder, you know, had... And the CPUSA as a whole had initially viewed Roosevelt publicly and the New Deal as incipient fascism, you know, that this was a Rooseveltian fascism that was going to be, you know, taking over the United States. And when this 1935 course correction happened, suddenly they said, no, actually, the New Deal is a potential jumping off point for a future workers' government. You have all these public works programs. This could demonstrate, you know, what the government could potentially do for ordinary people, both in delivering things to them and providing jobs. And it's like, well, imagine what we could do if we had an actual, you know, proletarian dictatorship or something. That was sort of the pitch that they were been making. Now, he had been, you know, again, a lot of this period you see over and over again, he'll take one particular line because he's told to, then he'll negotiate behind the scenes, say, let's do a different course of action. Then he'll equally enthusiastically say the exact opposite of what he'd been saying before. Eventually, congressional Republicans summoned Browder to testify on the New Deal and FDR to basically try to suggest that FDR was tacitly supporting the Communist Party in the United States. And he stupidly said some things that his lawyer wanted him to, you know, take the fifth and not self-incriminate, but he answered too quickly before they could tell him to shut up. So he ended up incriminating himself about using false passports to conduct his international work for the Soviet Union before he had become party leader. He basically used false documents to get out into and out of the country without being monitored. And he, for some reason, told a congressional panel this, so he got sent to prison for 14 months. FDR ended up commuting his sentence before the full sentence because of the U.S. entry into World War II. So Pearl Harbor happens in December of 1941, and also the, you know, attack on this, you know, Soviet Union by the Nazis that happened in the middle of 1941. And there was a U.S. Diplomatic trip happening. The Soviet foreign minister was coming to the United States in May of 1942. So at that point, FDR commuted his sentence. Earl Browder returns to serving as in the leadership of the Communist Party USA. But the party had some significant problems after that initial period of sort of popular front before World War II. Membership peaked at 75,000 in 1938, and then what happens the next year is the around that time is the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, which was the partially secret, partially public non-aggression pact deal between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany. So very abruptly, the Communist Party USA's position shifts to, again, criticizing the leadership of the U.S. government and FDR and saying that actually it's okay that the Nazis are that the Soviets are working with the Nazis. And then specifically, this really ramps up in December of 1939. At that point, Poland had capitulated to the Nazis, and per the secret protocols of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, part of Poland gets handed over along with some of the Baltic republics to the Soviet Union, and they were basically making a lot of excuses for this. They had had this big spike in membership as they had come to this more conciliatory position in the pre-war period, but a lot of people were very uncomfortable with this. They didn't like Hitler, they didn't like the Soviet Union's cooperation with that, and they were very skeptical, and it became super clear that they were just parroting the exact talking points that were given to them by Moscow. That made a lot of people unwilling to remain as part of this. In June of 1941, when Hitler invaded the USSR, the policy switched again. Suddenly, the CPUSA was very pro-war within the U.S. context of saying the U.S. should enter World War II, and they were anti-strike. So they, very enthusiastically stepped up and say, well, they didn't say unpatriotic, but, it's a blow to the efforts against Hitlerism if we have a strike at any of the factories that are producing war materials for, again, as we just talked about, these critical lend-lease shipments. Browder, again, was in prison during this early phase of the Nazi invasion of the USSR and the U.S. entry into World War II. While he was basically out of power temporarily, the party adopted a series of specific demands related to the war effort, which would be compatible, in their view, with both the overall communist ideology and the specific efforts against Nazi Germany. So they did try to make an effort to square the circle there of saying, like, well, we're not completely changing our positions here, but we're saying that, we have to put our differences aside. And specifically, they emphasized things like that there should be federal anti-racism and anti-discrimination policies enacted, because that would be helpful to the war effort. And it was consistent with their, existing policies, as Nate talked about with the sharecropper organizing and so forth. However, as things fell into increasing chaos during the war itself, by the course of 1943, when Earl Browder was now back in power, they were getting very little communication from Moscow as to what the party line was supposed to be. So Browder at this point, who sort of had his own, little miniature Stalinist cult of personality built up within the CPUSA, which also made a lot of people uncomfortable, he started trying to sort of take a little bit more autonomy and independence in his decision making. And he ended up in 1944 dissolving the Communist Party of the United States in favor of a looser Communist Association of the United States, because without guidance from Moscow, he mistakenly believed that there was about to be a period of permanent U.S.-Soviet harmony that would follow the war, and that communists had a duty to therefore integrate openly and publicly into the fabric of American society and show, oh, we're not so different from you, our neighbors, and this was going to be their, roadmap to building class consciousness and eventually leading to a peaceful proletarian transition or something like this. Eventually, however, at the very end of the war, the authorities in Moscow started reasserting control over their various parties around the world, and they were not happy with this decision. They said it had been a mistake, and they, I guess this was how they would sometimes communicate these things. They instructed the French communist leadership to publish a scathing editorial saying that Earl Browder had made a mistake and that, adopted an incorrect party line and that he shouldn't have dissolved the party. And everyone was like, okay, I'm pretty sure that the French communists don't actually care what the U.S. Communist Party leadership is doing unless they're being told to run this by Moscow. And subsequently, much later, evidence was found proving that that had been the case. So Browder was eventually removed from power, and that sort of ended that era. The Soviets, of course, spent basically all of 1944 in, invading various Axis and Nazi-occupied countries in Eastern and Central Europe so that they would have as many of them under their sphere of influence as possible. But that sort of ended that phase of the Communist Party, and that of course coincides around the time with the end of FDR's tenure when he passed away in 1944, and that, you know, we're not talking this week about the post-war period and the second Red Scare. That's sort of my recap of what the Communist Party was working on during the FDR administration, their kind of wild seesawing back and forth. Nate or Greg, did you have any comments or thoughts on any of that?
In fairness to the Soviets, it does appear that Browder was not operating under the correct assumptions, because it did not turn out exactly, the relations between the Soviets and the U.S. did not turn out exactly the way that he was envisioning they were going to when he dissolved CPUSA. So,
I mean, the part I can't figure out is why did he think that was going to happen?
I don't know.
Because even if you're saying, well, I have to act without instructions from Moscow because I'm not getting instructions from Moscow, why would you... Like, everyone should have been able to see that things were probably not going to be great between, you know, the capitalists and the communists, or whatever, however you want to frame it, in the post-war period. Even if you didn't know how bad the Cold War was going to get, presumably this was sort of an anomalous period, right?
And the amount of times that they changed their stance on FDR in particular, I would assume that you would operate with the degree of caution and not make any very large decisions when you're not receiving any instructions from higher up. Instead of just assuming, like, yes, I think that this course is the course that we are going to maintain and continue building upon for the foreseeable future, when all indications over the last 10 years have suggested that that's never happened.
Maybe he thought it was Hegelian dialectics, and that they had reached the synthesis of the thesis and antithesis, you know, and that the synthesis was a looser association of friendly, happy communists integrated into American public life.
Something like that. I mean, maybe he was just kind of dumb. I don't know.
Nate, your thoughts on this?
When was the slogan, communism is just like 20th century Americanism?
I think that was during this period.
Mm-hmm.
I think so.
Because there was an attempt to sort of just being like all American communists, like, this is just normal. Like, this is America. So,
yeah. And I think
that strategy is probably better than like closely associating yourself with just Russia. Like,
yeah.
Americans don't really know what that is.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right about that. That sort of the Achilles heel of all of this, aside from the overall structural issues of trying to build class consciousness in the United States toward a proletarian revolution, was just that, you know, Americans didn't really like the notion of somebody taking orders from a foreign country or whatever, you know, foreign power. So, like, that probably was not the way to go. You know, I don't know. You know, it's harder to gauge, like, oh, what would be the, you know, a uniquely American version of communism or something like that. Obviously, that's outside of my area of knowledge. But yeah.
Right. But you had like Aaron Copland and all sorts of things like that, where it was like there was kind of a moment of that. Like,
yeah, the common man. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but that was like a pretty limited moment, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I think I don't know a whole lot about it, but I've heard that, like, in the immediate sort of aftermath, you know, before, like, the big Red Scare stuff starts ramping up again, in that sort of narrow window of, like, well, it's not great relationship, but it's not disastrous yet. And this was before all the, like, union purges of communists and so forth, which was attempting to undo the integrationist policy from the New Deal era that the Communist Party had enacted. My understanding is that in Hawaii, the Communist Party was very heavily involved in training activists, particularly in the Democratic Party there, in the territory of Hawaii, on how to organize and agitate for statehood. The Republicans were very dominant in the territory. They had been since the, you know, 1890s or whatever, or even earlier than that. And they were not necessarily that interested in upgrading from territorial status. I think they liked having these, you know, pineapple colonies and sugarcane colonies and that kind of thing. And the Communist Party in Hawaii provided a substantial amount of training, as I've understood it, but I don't have a lot of great resources on that. I'm just remembering having read about that previously, that they, you know, helped like organize and teach people how to organize themselves so they could agitate for statehood. And then subsequently the Democratic Party had a pretty solid lock on most of the state, once it did gain statehood. But, you know, almost immediately after that, the communists got purged. But again, that's outside of the scope of what we're talking about today, because we're pretty much trying to focus on the FDR and then a little bit of the Truman administration, which brings us to our final area that we wanted to talk about, which was Vice President Henry A. Wallace. This was FDR's agriculture secretary, a former progressive Republican, who then became a Democrat. So he was the agriculture secretary for a number of years, and then he was put on the ticket in 1940 to become vice president and served one term as vice president. And then he was dropped from the 1944 ticket, and then subsequently remained in the cabinet in the Truman administration for a number of years, but then ran for president in a very ill-fated but famous run for president as a third party candidate in 1948. So we wanted to talk a little bit about that, because he was sort of the highest profile American politician ever to be sort of even closely associated at all with the Communist Party. And it wasn't particularly close from his perspective, but it ended up becoming sort of a political liability for him. But it also speaks to this issue of U.S.-Soviet relations, because he was very instrumental in that. I don't know where we should start on that. I guess we could talk about his initial tenure as agriculture secretary before he became vice president, because a lot of that stuff ended up coming up later. Greg, I know you wanted to talk about the German-Russian guru that he built a relationship with as agriculture secretary, which came back to haunt him when he was running for president.
Yes. So when I was initially reading about this in the outline, it stuck out to me, because I think I have maybe Marianne Williamson on the brain. There's this German-Russian guru named Nicholas Roerich.
Roerich or something.
Yeah. I suspected that I was not pronouncing that correctly. But in any case, one of the things that happened during his tenure as the secretary of the U.S. Department of Agriculture is he sponsored an expedition with this guru and a couple of scientists, and they went to Inner Mongolia, Manchuria, and China in 1934 through 1935. And the purpose of that expedition was to collect seeds, which were supposed to protect, you know, layers of soil, which from the perspective of things that we have talked about over the course of, you know, this show, certainly is something that, you know, it's sort of like environmental conservationist, but also, you know, involved with agriculture or whatever. As it turns out, things didn't go very well, and so that was one of the things that he ended up having to answer for in later in his political career. And then there was also some sort of weird letters that he had written to this guru as well. And this guru is not a nobody by any stretch of the imagination. During World War II, he was in India, and Nehru and Indira Gandhi, he hosted them at his house, and they were talking about what is the world going to look like when the war is over. How are we going to shape the new world? But I don't think that it sat particularly well in U.S. politics to have this person that had this weird relationship with this German-Russian guru, for maybe the sort of similar reasons that people didn't like when Browder was taking orders from the Communist Party as, you know, the head of the CPUSA, that there might have been some concern that Wallace was, you know, taking orders from this German-Russian spiritual advisor.
We were talking before we recorded the show, though, that it's interesting that this is not something that has completely gone away. I mean, even setting aside someone like Marianne Williamson, that in world politics, we still in the modern era occasionally have these sort of Rasputin-like figures that pop up to influence politics. I know, Nate, you were mentioning South Korea, I think, and I was talking about Sri Lanka, that we periodically see these like presidents that are associated with these astrologer types and people like that. And then, of course, Nancy Reagan, I think, had an astrologer as well that she was consulting. So I guess that didn't negatively impact Ronald Reagan in the way that it, the spiritual oneness of being or whatever that Henry Wallace was conversing with this guy on had on his career.
Yeah, he said that he was a mystic. So his grandfather died in 1916 and he left the Presbyterian Church, and then he starts to get interested in mysticism. And so then he says, you know, I know I'm often called a mystic, and in the years following my leaving the United Presbyterian Church, I was probably a practical mystic. I'd say I was a mystic in the sense that George Washington Carver was, who believed God was in everything, and therefore if you went to God, you could find the answers. And so, you know, he was also, you know, conversing with the Nicholas Roich, or however you may say his last name, and then gave him this. I it's not clear to me that the guru had any experience, any reason to be on that expedition collecting the seeds at all, if not because he was a spiritual advisor to Henry Wallace. So it's a bit strange.
Now, the other sort of really controversial thing that ended up coming back to haunt Wallace was his 1944 Soviet tour. So this was his final year as vice president before he was dropped from the 1944 ticket. And this had a serious negative impact on both the 1944 race, of him potentially remaining vice president, as well as his 1948 presidential campaign. So he was sent on an official mission as vice president of the United States to tour the Soviet Union. Subsequently, in 1952, he said that he basically felt like he had been duped, but at the time he sort of gave this glowing review. He was sent to like look at a work camp or something, which was in pretty horrible Stalinist conditions. A lot of these camps during the Stalinist period were ethnic minorities that were deported to places and so forth. But this particular camp, they had sort of like cleaned it up a bit for like, you know, I guess Potemkin village type thing, to make it look all shiny and happy. And the communist officials that were showing him around tried to say that, oh, these are volunteers. I think he had some comment about this is like, you know, the works project or no, the, this is the Tennessee Valley Authority meets Hudson's Bay Company. So sort of this like frontier life, you know, where we were working together and to eke out a existence and, you know, but we're also building this collective state power and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, the Tennessee Valley Authority was a major project of the New Deal in the United States. So you could make that comparison and people would understand, but not really getting an accurate reflection of what was happening. But as a result of this 1944 tour, he had a lot of very positive things to say about Stalin. And even in the context of the war effort, this made a lot of people in the United States, and I should say the leadership people in the United States, pretty uncomfortable. At the 1944 convention, this along with his pretty consistent support of civil rights as the agriculture secretary, and opposing Jim Crow and so forth, he wasn't necessarily someone who was initially, you know, really into this, but was eventually sort of converted by lower level staffers of like, we need to, you know, end the sharecropping discrimination, we need to end Jim Crow, we need to do all these things in the South to make life better for African Americans. Yeah. This did not go over well with the Southern Democrats, who sort of held the balance of power in the party at the time. And they were very upset with the idea of him remaining as vice president, because at that point, everyone knew FDR was not in great health and was probably not going to make it through a full term. And it wasn't clear yet how soon the war was going to end. Obviously, it ended up ending, you know, in the middle of 1945. But at the time, there were a lot of assumptions that it was going to keep going to, you know, 1946 and maybe even beyond, depending on how long the Pacific War took. And so they pushed really hard to drop him from the ticket. And Nate, I think you wanted to talk a little bit about that convention and sort of how he ends up getting swapped out for Harry Truman.
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a lot of sort of backroom dealings. And I think at one point, FDR was basically saying to him, oh, I want you, if I can do it, I'll get you on the ticket. And just didn't really aggressively follow up on that. And you ended up, the party hacks put one of their own, Truman, one of the biggest party hacks to ever become president, in there. So that happened. And yeah, basically, as you mentioned, Bill, he was still on the cabinet, right?
Yeah. So FDR basically, as a consolation thing, said, it's okay, even if you get dropped from the ticket, because he really wasn't going to put that much effort into keeping him on the ticket. Even if you get dropped from the ticket, you'll still get to be in the cabinet. You can have any position you want except for the State Department.
Right. And he sort of teamed up a bit with Eleanor Roosevelt, and with congressional allies, he helped pass the Employment Act of 1946. Although conservatives, they basically blocked a full employment provision, but they established through the act the Council of Economic Advisors, Joint Economic Committee to study economic matters. So, yeah. And he also wanted international control over nuclear weapons, right? He want to just give the plans to the Soviets, just being like, hey, you know, you guys have some of these nuclear weapons too, and then we don't have to worry about all of this stuff.
Right.
So that didn't happen.
That was, I mean, that's sort of where the real controversy starts, right? So after the 1944 elections and, you know, 1945, the new administration, or the FDR's final administration, is sworn in. And then a few months later, he dies and Truman becomes president. So Wallace is Commerce Secretary at this point. And basically the reason he picked that was because obviously he had done a lot of work already at agriculture, but commerce, he figured, was going to oversee most of the post-war transition away from all the, you know, economic wartime controls and things. And he wanted to do that in a certain way, which mostly, you know, there were some successes, as Nate says, but mostly I think everyone at Commerce struggled because of the sort of Republican and Dixiecrat backlash to a lot of the post-war measures. There were a lot of people who for some reason thought that you could just flip a switch, like, okay, the war is done, you know, everything go back to normal, and that caused a lot of economic problems. But he initially was, as you said, working very closely with Eleanor Roosevelt. He was also the and President Truman, he was the only cabinet member who did not get sacked as part of the transition from Truman to from FDR to Truman after FDR died. Pretty much everyone else got dismissed almost immediately or relatively quickly. And Truman basically realized Wallace probably was the absolute most knowledgeable person in the entire administration, apart from former First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, as to anything that was going on. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that Truman was not briefed on at all. Whereas, you know, I think as Nate was just alluding to, Henry Wallace had not necessarily like super detailed information on the Manhattan Project and so forth, but he did have some information and was kind of involved in that and various other specific wartime efforts as vice president and previously as agriculture secretary. So Truman did keep him on. And initially for the first, you know, two or so years, things seemed pretty okay. But the issue was that they started having this significant difference of opinion, as Nate mentions, with the nuclear weapons issue as to what the U.S. policy should be regarding the Soviet Union. Now, at this point, he still was being pretty, you know, conciliatory towards Stalin and had a good impression from that 1944 tour. And so he was advocating on that basis for much less hawkish relationship. And that is not what Truman wanted, is not what the party leadership wanted, is not what State Department wanted, is not what the what became subsequently the CIA wanted. It's not what a lot of the military people wanted. So increasingly, Wallace felt very isolated by this, and eventually he explicitly denounced the foreign policy of the emerging Cold War and hawkishness toward the Soviet Union. And it didn't endear him, and so eventually he was asked to resign after a number of years because he made a particularly controversial speech, and Truman's people had to say, like, that's not the position of the administration.
So, yeah, he said that we should recognize that we have no more business in the political affairs of Eastern Europe than Russia has in the political affairs of Latin America, Western Europe, and the United States. So he was giving in front of a pro-Soviet crowd, so they booed him because of that. But then the Truman administration were also very mad, so...
It was a real no-win.
Yeah, sometimes hard to win, yeah.
He wasn't, I mean, I think that it's very evident that he was not a good politician. Like, and I think that that's probably to his credit. That's probably, like, why he was, I guess, like, not so rigid about, you know, the Soviet question. That's why he was probably, you know, anti-Jim Crow. And
he was a good manager, a good bureaucrat, basically.
Yes, yes. But I think, and that's one of the points that there's this biography of him called American Dreamer, The Life and Times of Henry A. Wallace by George C. Culver and John Hyde that was written in 2000. And that's one of the things that they really point out is that, like, he did, you know, I mean, it's in the title. It's American Dreamer. I mean, like, this guy was very oriented towards these big ideas and not really so much about personal relationships. So he didn't really care who he made angry. He just had this, had this vision. And, you know, and for some parts of his political career, that really worked for him. And then for other parts of his political career, it really didn't.
Yeah, so the 1948 presidential campaign, he ends up running as this third-party candidate. It's, you know, initially looks like it might be promising. He gets all these endorsements from a lot of, you know, lefty intellectuals and things like that. Yeah,
Paul Robeson, George McGovern.
And this increasingly just completely falls apart into one of the most disastrous presidential campaigns ever. Now, some of this was not his fault, right? There were things like he was very vocally opposed to Jim Crow, and he refused to have segregated events in the South when he was campaigning. So, you know, he would either insist that a facility allow him to have, you know, a fully integrated crowd with the, you know, same entrances or whatever, and or else he wouldn't speak. And so that didn't help him. Not that saying that he shouldn't have done anything different, but just explaining what happened. There was one state, I think it was Virginia, where they basically decided to say, well, all Henry Wallace events are a private function, so therefore segregation laws don't apply. It's, you can do whatever you want at a private function. But obviously, you know, the Southern Democrats were furious about a lot of this, and he was running third party anyway. And then we talked already about the letters that came up from the guru. There was also increasingly clear that he had been led astray on the Soviets. Even if we're not criticizing him over saying it would be good to have, you know, positive relationships with the other major superpower rather than hostile relationships, because I think that's our view, is probably, you know, even if they're doing stuff that we don't agree with, you want to maintain cordial relationships with the what subsequently was going to be the other nuclear power for a while, and, you know, the other enormous military power in the world. But the other thing that happened with that was that during the campaign, in 1948, the communists staged a coup in Czechoslovakia. They were sort of already pretty influential there, but not explicitly like single party control. And they did a coup on the orders of the Soviet Union. And he basically, leads back to the speech that Nate was talking about earlier, where he just was like, well, it's not our business. Like, that's not our sphere of the world. So, you know, I'm not going to say anything negative about it. And at that point, he starts hemorrhaging a lot of support, even people that had been enthusiastic about him, because they were pretty uncomfortable with the Soviet activities in Eastern Europe at the time. And then you also definitely have a lot of issues where, like, newspapers that were really out to get him, you know, right-wing newspapers would start publishing lists, like blacklists, of anybody that was endorsing him or supporting him or had donated money or whatever they could find. So it became really controversial to even associate with him. Now, of course, 1948 ends up being that nail-biter race between Truman and Dewey. Now, some people have said, oh, maybe it wouldn't have been such a close race if Wallace hadn't been in the race, but there's not a lot of great polling, which is one of the reasons it was such a surprise when Truman actually managed to win his own term. But yeah, it was sort of just this huge rolling fiasco from almost the beginning of the campaign. And he kind of later said, oh, I made some mistakes and things like that. But that also, you know, he didn't do himself any favors by having the Communist Party endorse him as the Red Scare is starting to kick off again. And he basically was like, well, I didn't ask for their endorsement, but whatever, that's fine if they want to support me. But, you know, a lot of people were uncomfortable with that. Again, not necessarily saying that he was in the wrong here, but, like, politically, as Greg said, not necessarily the most adept or whatever.
Yeah.
Obviously, like, later, after he's, like, in retirement, you know, he ends up kind of reconsidering a lot of the foreign policy views that he had toward the Soviet Union anyway. But it was kind of a mess in 48.
Yeah. The last time I was on, you know, was in the direct aftermath of the first Democratic debates. And I think that one of the criticisms that all three of us leveled at a lot of the candidates that were on stage is that they were kind of, like, you know, licking their fingers and holding it up to the wind to see which way it was blowing. And Henry Wallace just appears to be the antithesis of that, where he's just like, I don't really care what way the wind is blowing. This is just who I am. This is what I believe in. And so that is what, you know, led to him probably having a more reasonable stance on the Soviet Union, but perhaps not politically the right stance, a more reasonable stance on Jim Crow, but perhaps not the politically, you know, viable one. So, but again, I, like we're saying, we're not saying that these are the wrong positions to have. It's just that, you know, if you want to win in 1948, then it's going to be a uphill battle.
Now, to wrap up our episode for this week, not to end on potentially too depressing of a note, but Nate, I was wondering your thoughts on this. So there's a lot of kind of, you know, in the sort of lefty spectrum, you know, obviously, during his 48 campaign, he, you know, ends up, his running mate was Idaho senator and former actor Glenn Taylor, who was kind of often also accused of being a socialist. He was very vocally against the foreign policy of containment under the Truman Doctrine. He was also loudly anti-Jim Crow. People look at that 48 campaign, if they're sort of progressives or lefty liberals, and to some extent some, you know, more social democratic leftists. Or they look at 1944 and what could have happened, you know, if he had been kept on the ticket and then became president when FDR died. And there's a lot of what if, what if, what if, you know, oh, things could have been totally different for this country. I was wondering what you thought about that, because to my mind, not to get too cynical about it, but best case scenario, I feel like he would have been really hamstrung. I mean, we talked at the top of the episode about how there's that book on how even FDR, this, you know, wildly charismatic politician with tremendous popular support and enormous congressional majorities, still being kind of stymied by the policy, the bureaucratic infrastructure that never goes away, at whether it's the State Department or one of the other departments, agitating against
the deep state.
Well, so that's what I wanted to get to, right? Is because even if they're the diplomatic corps or economic, you know, Commerce Department people, but then of course in this period of World War II and the immediate aftermath, we have this huge buildup of an intelligence apparatus closely affiliated to the State Department, but also, you know, within the Defense Department or the emergent CIA. What best case scenario, it seems to me that he would have really found it hard to get anything done with these sort of career bureaucrats opposing reconciliation or continued conciliation toward the Soviet Union. Do you see this as a real, you know, oh, things might have been totally different? Or do you think that, and I'm not even laying out the worst case here, but do you think he would have been able to do anything?
Yes, things would have been significantly different. I don't know if they still would have dropped nuclear bombs. The military might have just, because they barely told Truman about that, so they might have just done it anyway. But I mean, if we're thinking about sort of the early Cold War, you can't deny that there would be a significant difference in posture, whether that, you know, how that goes from there, because there's a lot of different phases of the Cold War and whatnot. It's tough to say. You know, there's a lot of historical, reckoning or evaluating his legacy. Greg mentioned the book that came out recently, American Dreamer, which I think I have, and I've been meaning to read it. But
well, 2000, so that's not that recent.
Yeah, well, okay, but it's like, you know, still 21st century. But right. And I think there has been a lot more discussion of him somewhat more recently. So there is a historian, Thomas Devine, wrote in 2013 that newly available Soviet sources do confirm Wallace's position that Moscow's behavior was not as relentlessly aggressive as many believed at the time. And of course, like, they thought that, you know, Soviet T-34s or whatever going to like roll into France and whatnot, and that was never really on the cards. Like, the Soviet military had no plans to do that, basically. But Devine also wrote that enough new information has come to light to cast serious doubt on both Wallace's benign attitude towards Stalin's intention and his dark conspiratorial view of the Truman administration. So you also have people talking about he's the most famous almost president, with the exception of Al Gore, in U.S. history. Before this episode, Bill, we were talking a little bit about how he like pioneered a hybrid corn production, and there was a lot of chickens that he produced. Like, at one point,
yeah, he did know a lot about agriculture.
Of commercial, he wasn't, eggs.
Yeah, he wasn't just a political appointee to Agriculture Department. Like, he knew a lot about farm stuff and farm science.
So, and his, and we were talking before about Copeland. His, like, a speech of his actually inspired the whole century of the common man type of thing. So you know, I, you know, from what it seems, I don't think president was his, you know, calling in life or whatever, but it definitely
seems apparently
like
he was interested as early as 1940 when they weren't sure if FDR was going to run for a third term. He was, as agriculture secretary, was like starting to put out feelers to run for president.
Yeah. But I think, yeah, I mean, things could have been very different, but you know, you have like on one hand, the, Oliver Stone, argument is like there would have been no atomic bombings, no nuclear arms race, and no Cold War. And then people at the National View are like, oh, he would have done a policy of appeasement and allowed the spread of communism to Iran, Greece, and Italy. And it's like, is that supposed to be bad? I don't know. Like, we were siding with fascists, like in Greece and, you know, Italy. We had to break the unions and rig the elections and stuff. And of course, Iran, we've done episodes on Iran. So,
yeah. I mean, I just, my thing is like, you know, given the sort of turmoil of the post-war period and so forth, like it seems hard to envision a situation in which there's not, you know, whether it's a military figure or the Southern Democrats or some, you know, rogue intelligence operative or whatever, you know, that's really hawkish against the Soviets. Like it's hard not to imagine that they, you know, wouldn't have tried to like assassinate him if he became president. I mean, I don't know. It just like, it's hard not to think that that might've been a
probably
possible
no precedent
outcome
for any of that. Right.
Anyway. All right. That is our, history episode on US Soviet relations and the Communist Party activities during the FDR period, in the United States. We are almost to the end of our summer podcast run, just a little bit more to go, of our public policy and history coverage. As I said, starting next week, we're going to be talking about, anarchists in the late 19th century and early 20th century. A lot of that has to do with, various, European immigrants as well. So it's an interesting, multifaceted topic. And of course, you know, there's a lot of, early 19th century, you know, precursors and so forth, which, we were having a conversation off air about before, we were recorded. So I'm excited to, talk about that. Greg, thank you so much for coming on the show this week and filling in for Rachel. I really appreciate hearing from you as always.
Thanks for having me as always.
And Nate, thanks for being on and helping me with the research for this.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks, Greg.